It's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 5th of March, 2016. Island Life is Waiheke Radio's weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, and it's brought to you with the support of the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. I'm Chris Walker, and on Saturday the 5th of March, I spoke to the director of movie Orphans and Kingdoms, Polo Rotondo. I was joined by the opinionated Islanders Alan Knight and Bruce Davis Goff. I spoke with Miriam Lawler from the Waiheke Island Council of Social Services, and the band Radio Ribaldi joined me in the studio. The movie Orphans and Kingdoms has been described as a taut, unnerving drama, and the film will have its New Zealand premiere on April the 5th. It was filmed right here on Waiheke Island, and shortly we'll be talking to the director, Polo Rotondo. But first, let's take a listen to the trailer.
Get out.
Just wanted somewhere to stay for a while. We thought this place was empty.
How do you think you are?
This is my home.
Let
my goddamn home!
We'll get you home, bro.
No, you won't. Who knows where they'll send us?
Where will you go? What about your family?
You're our family. We're wards of the state. We're everyone's kids.
I don't want to go back. My old man's here. I'm not going back to another bunch of strangers. Let go of me!
You have to get off this island. Now.
Why are you doing this?
Look, we don't have much time. Please. Let me do this.
Now, we just heard the trailer for Orphans and Kingdoms, and the man who directed that movie will be known to some of you as an actor from TV and film, notably Shortland Street, also a thespian, but he also was a common face around the island living here. Polo, welcome to Waiheke Radio. How are you?
Hey, Chris, I'm really well. How are you?
Excellent. So this must be exciting coming up to the opening of your movie.
Yeah, man, it's been a long time coming, and I've been having I had to keep quiet about it for such a long time while we did the international circuit with the film before we got to release it in New Zealand. So there was like an army of Waihikians who helped on the film that I couldn't tell them when the release was. So it's bloody good to be able to say, hey, we're going to finally get it out there in the world, and
so speaking
and your hard work is going to.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Yeah,
and speaking of the international circuit, you've been picking up a number of accolades, haven't you, around the world with the movie?
Yes, I think today, look, I'm going to do something sneaky. Today I can reveal that we just won another one this week. We won Best Cinematography at a film festival called La Cruces in New Mexico. And it's quite a big and important festival. And so Simon Raby, New Zealand cinematographer, who's really well known, just won Best Cinematographer. So Orphans and Kingdoms is, Waiheke is being seen everywhere from India to Alaska to Europe. So it's kind of cool, you know, that they see we're showing a bit of our backyard all over the world.
Absolutely. So tell us, just give us kind of a little overview of what the movie's about.
Well, the essential plot sort of setup of the story is pretty straightforward. It's like, there's three kids, foster kids, right? And they're going to be separated. And they come from what people call the wrong side of the tracks, basically across the water in Auckland, let's just face it. Yeah, they come from the wrong side of the tracks. And they don't want to be split up, so they think Waiheke Island. Winter time, massive empty holiday homes. So they come across here and to Waiheke, and they with the intention of breaking in and hiding out in a house that's empty for a while, which is also based on a whole lot of Waiheke anecdotes, by the way. I mean, everyone's heard about the guy who got caught in Waiheke, who answered the door to the police in a bathrobe in one of the mansions that was empty. I thought that was quite funny. So I stole that idea. But the house that they break into, these kids, isn't empty. There's a guy living there, a lonely guy, and he's got his own demons of his own. And when he turns up at home, the kids have raided the liquor cabinet, partied big time, and they find themselves knocking a guy unconscious and end up in this situation. And the course of the story takes place over one night, and the tables turn on the story. And by the next morning, they've developed some kind of... the relationship has changed dramatically because of what's revealed throughout the night. And when the police come looking for them, knocking at the door, the four of them find themselves on the run together. And so it's kind of like a... It's a drama, essentially. Pretty intense drama, all taking place in one night.
The intensity actually comes through even in the trailer, and also another thing that comes through, and you mentioned that you're picking up awards for cinematography, is that it does look stunning, but the island itself is kind of prominent. You know, the island is, it looks to me one of those movies where location almost becomes one of the characters of the movie.
Absolutely, dude. I mean, even in our promo, you see, we have one house, one island, one night. You know, it's this idea of dislocation that, an island, not Waiheke specifically, but the idea of living on an island for me is a metaphor for New Zealand as a whole. So Waiheke just kind of was perfect. And also, Waiheke kind of is like this microcosm for me of Aotearoa as a whole, because it's incredibly beautiful, incredibly... It's an island, it's a paradise of a place to live in, but it's also hiding quite a few demons underneath the surface, you know, and I thought that, you know, using Waiheke as an island is a perfect way of describing our greater New Zealand society, you know, because if you try to make a story that's generalised, it's really difficult. And also Waiheke is a community, and so there's lots of story elements that work very, very differently from a normal town somewhere on the mainland, so to speak. But yeah, and we chose to shoot Waiheke in the winter because also, you know, the beautiful Waiheke image of, you know, Onetangi and Palm Beach is quite well known. It's known internationally. But the sort of majestic beauty of Waiheke in the winter as well is something that isn't celebrated on camera. And it lends itself to the beautiful cinematography, as you see. So
yeah, that moodiness.
We didn't go out to make a postcard because it's all story related, but... You just point a 35mm camera at Waiheke and you've got beautiful images. It's impossible not to appreciate.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that there were a number of local people involved in the making of it. I mean, what were the kind of range of roles that locals were involved with?
You know, we had everyone from like Island Coffee to people lending us their utes to people giving us their houses for accommodation of the crew, because, you know, imagine bringing 40... We were a low-budget film, by the way. We were part of the New Zealand Film Commission's escalator scheme, which was like, yeah, we'll give you a small amount of money and we won't look over your shoulder too much. Go away and make a film. And so we did that. So we weren't paying everyone very well, so we had to beg, borrow and steal from everyone. And so, you know, we even had locals... That thing that happens only in Waiheke, giving rides to cast members who had to make their own way across on the ferry and stuff like that. So, you know, I had everyone from also Oyster Inn accommodating actors and, you know, offering drinks on a Friday night. I had Stefano's Pizzeria after a particularly hard week said no, you know, because Stephen Hollings used to own... Stefan was in the film, and so we got him to and he volunteered to have his place, and he fed the entire crew. It was pretty awesome. You know, my mother put people up. It was all that kind of stuff that you get on Waiheke that I think makes, because it's a community in a different way from most places, it consolidates a team in a different way.
So
yeah, we had a big component of these, our lighting crew was this volcanic volcanic film lighting, they're called volcanic lighting, group of Māori boys, and they went fishing every opportunity they possibly could, getting kaimoana from around the island. They thought it was the best shoot they ever had. It was awesome.
Fantastic. So what's next for the movie?
Well, we have this is where it's interesting, we've got this gala opening at the Civic in Auckland. And the reason we're doing that is because we haven't had a proper cast and crew where everyone's got to see it, but we're also using it to raise funds for the release because, as you know, independent films don't, we just don't have any money. So we have to raise a bit of dosh to make, to help with publicity and to get the marketing out. And then on April 14th, it goes to various cinemas around New Zealand. And so we've had really great cinemas like the Waiheke Cinema.
Yeah, well, it's bound to be popular here.
Well, you know, it would be crazy if every Waihekian didn't come and see it. Now, it's got some adult content in the respect of its themes. You can tell from the trailer, they're serious themes. But I actually think it's a film that would be, that's got quite important for younger people to see as well, but it's not for younger people without parental guidance.
Yeah.
Because of some of the themes in there are pretty strong, I would say, and that's precisely why they should see it, but at the same time, they need a parent to go along with them. And it's very popular on the art house circuit. Because
I was just about to say, I mean, with the look of it, with the awards you've been picking up, it looks like it has the potential to be an addition to that canon of, you know, that film noir that that Sam Neill talks about, you know, that kind of gothic darkness of some of the best New Zealand movies.
Absolutely. It's doing really well. You know, it's it does fit into that heritage of New Zealand films. But at the same time, what's right from the outset, creatively, we decided to, we wanted to see if we could make a film with a European sensibility. And so, you know, I'm half Italian and I'm more educated in Italian film than New Zealand film, nearly. So we set out with a style of story and a kind of performance style that was like a European film, and got an Italian composer to give it a feel.
Was that a relative? Because you share a last name.
Yes, it was a relative.
Yep.
I know, it's very Italian, so nepotistic, eh? Just get the cubs to come along and do the music. But no, he trained at the Centro Sperimentale di Cinematografia, which is the place where Ennio Morricone, who just won an Oscar the other night, teaches. And he studied there in Rome, and he's a tutor there. So basically, he's a colleague of Ennio Morricone, who's probably the most famous composer in cinema. And we got him because music gives a sets a tone. There's a pun actually. Music it gives a feel to a film, which is very distinct, and the music is absolutely Italian and European in its feel. And so what we've done is we've taken this New Zealand tradition of filmmaking and then we've blended it with a bit of European filmmaking style. And it seems to be crossing over. People recognise themselves in it. Europeans are really liking it. They think it's like a European film but just made in New Zealand. And Kiwis think it's just a real Kiwi film that's made with a slightly different style. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. So, well, I know we're all looking forward to it. And good luck with the gala screening. And we can't wait for it to open up at the community cinema on the island.
I would love it if some Waiheke representatives came over to the Civic screening.
What's the story? How can people get tickets for that event?
I think we've got orphansandkingdoms.co.nz as a site. And all the details will be launched on that, and then I guess we're going to do a media campaign with it to launch that these tickets are available to buy online and probably at the door. But it'll be really, I mean, I'm not sure what the price is at the moment because it hasn't been determined. We're still sort of working out with the Civic. Well, you know what we've got is those guys who do, Michael Meredith, who does the lunches for kids, who don't have food on their table.
Yep.
Eat my lunch. He really loves the kaupapa of the film, you know, the spirit in which we've made the film and what our themes are. And so he's actually preparing some catering that you can get on the night, you know, so you can go there and have a drink and eat one of Michael Meredith is one of the most amazing chefs in New Zealand. You can get eat one of his meals, and the proceeds go to his charity organisation, which provides school lunches for less fortunate New Zealand kids. And we thought that was a really lovely tie-in, because it's such a, you know, we're wearing our hearts on our sleeves, so to speak.
Fantastic. Well, look, it's been lovely talking to you, and good luck with the, as I say, with the opening. We look forward to it screening locally.
Orphansandkingdoms.co.nz. Please visit it and then come and check it out at the movies.
Great. Thanks very much.
See you, Waiheke. Ka kite. Bye-bye.
I've been talking to Paolo Rotondo, the director of Orphans and Kingdoms, which, as he says, has its gala opening at the Civic on the 5th of April and is opening at cinemas nationwide from April 14th.
Waiheke Radio.
You're listening to Island Life, this on Waiheke Radio. Island Life is our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, and it's brought to you with the support of the Humble Pie Village Butchery. And it's the first Saturday of the month, so we're joined by the opinionated Islanders, Alan Knight.
Good morning.
And stepping in for Alex Stone this month is Bruce Davis Goff.
Good morning, Waiheke.
So let's get you a bit closer to that microphone there, Bruce. So, plenty to talk about at the moment.
Yeah, where do we even begin?
Well, look, let's start off big. Why don't we start off with, because it's going to impact on the whole world, the presidential primaries in the US.
Of course, it reached a new low yesterday with Donald Trump, or Donald Drumpf, as we're all supposed to be calling him, actually getting, he has reached a new low in that he was describing the size of his old fella. He felt moved to actually do this during a debate. He said that the size of his hands was being mentioned, and this was obviously a slur on a different part of his anatomy, and that he wanted to assure everybody that there was no problem there, guaranteed.
Common consensus seems to be that it's not going to take much for him to actually whip the old fella out.
This is the thing. We've actually got to the point where you could imagine the circumstances under which Mr. Trump would, at a press conference, suddenly unzip and present himself to the world. You wouldn't rule it out anymore.
Now, Alan, you've got a bit of a historical perspective on this, I believe, because there was a former president who was also quite fond of...
Well, that's true. There is a precedent. Lyndon Johnson was very... he was very proud of his old chap and used to get it out at all manner of occasions. He said, hey, check this out. Well, look!
I hope you don't see it in New Zealand. There's a whole new meaning to a member of parliament.
Yes, exactly, yes. Politicians, just keep them zipped up. We really don't want to know.
So that American presidential race, while highly entertaining, is also incredibly scary at the same time.
It's terrifying, yeah, because it does look like the race now will be between Trump and Hillary Clinton, who gives me the impression that she's barking mad. So really, there's no good way forward with either of those candidates. Clinton will at least be taken a little bit seriously overseas, whereas that amazing superpower that Americans seem to have of not giving a damn what the rest of the world thinks of them, they're going to be drawing on that quite heavily, I think, even now, but certainly even more if that ludicrous, puffed-up orange bloke actually gets the presidency.
With his little hands.
With his little hands, yes.
Do you think, Bruce, that that he will be able to, you know, attract, you know, I mean, if he gets through this bit, I mean, is he going to appeal? If you look at those Republican voters, you have got some heavily conservative people, and his kind of brashness and crassness might be a turn-off for them. Do you think that he might actually be paving the way for a Clinton win?
Well, yes and no. Bernie made some very interesting points around this, saying that he seems to be attracting the bitter and disenfranchised, who are also very keen to turn their anger on minorities, Muslims, the poor, basically anyone they can turn their anger on, whereas where they should be turning it actually is on the American government itself. There's been other interesting things. Someone quoted this morning saying the Republicans really are reaping what they've sown, I think. You know.
Well, there was a marvelous quote that popped up yesterday from the author Stephen King, who said, for the last 8 years, the Republicans have been sowing dragon's teeth and are now horrified to find they've grown a dragon.
Yeah, that's right. I'm very interested in Bernie Sanders. It's been a point of much contention in our household. Angela, of course, my wife, a lovely wife, I know you're listening out there, she supports Hillary, of course, and I don't. I kind of feel like, yeah, she has done a lot for women's rights, but there is a bigger picture here, and that's around the massive inequality, the fact that Wall Street's been running rampant and has destroyed so many people's lives.
And that the various armaments manufacturers are all looking to Hillary Clinton going, yeah, she'll keep the wars going.
Yep, nothing like a good war.
Yes.
So let's bring it a bit closer to home, but maybe still with an international flavour. Do you think that the tide is turning on people's attitudes towards the South American community on the island?
There is certainly a bunch of ill feeling out there, which I'm very disappointed by. When you consider how many young people New Zealand exports to the rest of the world each year, because any young Kiwi with any spirit or imagination or intelligence wants to travel, and we encourage them to do it. We send them out into the world and hope that they'll do well and that other countries will look after them. I think it's a little shabby when we have particularly the Latino population that we get here every summer, without whom a great many of our businesses would simply not operate. If we have an economic miracle going on here, they are in very large part responsible for helping us achieve it. They're willing to come here for their holidays, live in their cars in many cases, live eight to a house or whatever, and work very hard. And yes, maybe one or two of them don't behave particularly well, but I'm quite sure you go around the world and it wouldn't be too difficult to find, say, at the time of the Munich Beer Festival or the running of the bulls at Pamplona, it wouldn't be too difficult to find some Kiwis behaving pretty revoltingly. Letting a bad impression of maybe one or two of them. I saw a couple of Argentinians being apprehended for shoplifting the other day in the supermarket, which was, you know, very sad to see. Like, oh, do you really have to behave like that? But the bulk of them have, of course, really transformed the island, particularly in summer, and maybe beyond that, because inevitably some of them will like it here enough to apply for citizenship. We have a couple of Latinos working at the brewery who have now been here for 3 or 4 years. They sort of came here on an OE, liked it, just felt that this was their sort of place and have settled.
Yeah, I was quite a bit surprised on Facebook to actually notice the vitriol being thrown in the way. And it was kind of, again, it's like the blame game.
Yeah.
I mean, with any culture, you're always going to have a few scallywags. And I think we had such an influx over the last few years that I think they've all gone home and said to their mates, come to Waiheke.
You've got place. Well, yes. I mean, they're clearly Waiheke has become for young Latinos what Earl's Court was to Australians and New Zealanders through the 60s, 70s and 80s. It's like, oh, when you get to New Zealand, you've got to go to Waiheke. I just assumed there were hundreds of thousands of them flooding in, but no, there are just a couple of thousand of them. It's just that they all happen to come here. We really do get a vast number of them. But yes, anyone out there who has a problem with them, really reassess your views would be my advice. What would happen if those folks didn't turn up one summer?
Well, that's right. I mean, there is things which aren't that great. We've spotted freedom campers up in Ellison Park, and spotted the leftover toilet paper remains from freedom campers up there. And I think that, you know, that's a bit off. But I also appreciate that, you know, these people are coming here, they're working, they're loving up the community. But one problem we do have is the lack of budget accommodation. There's just nowhere for them to sleep.
And meanwhile, the old Kinner Backpackers stands empty with Auckland City's branding outside it, just in case we forget who's responsible for keeping that number of beds and accommodation space out of use this summer. Thank you so much, Auckland City Council. No wonder we hate you. But I think also another thing that I've come across a couple of times is people saying, oh, well, you know, they come over here taking jobs from New Zealanders. Well, sorry, the number of school leavers that we have on the island each year would number what? What's the high school's average output of school leavers?
What, it would be under 100, I suppose.
Yeah. And what proportion of them are going to be going on to university or back into some sort of education? So the moment school holidays ends, they can't do any further work apart from Saturdays and Sundays. Plus, I was speaking to a well-known vineyard owner just recently who went, Hiring locals don't make me laugh. He said their work ethic is terrible. They don't turn up on time. They're really not reliable. And, you know, that's possibly a huge generalization. I can think of at least three or four local kids that we have working at the brewery who are just fine and incredibly reliable. But there is nowhere near enough local workforce to even make up a fraction of what the island requires between between the beginning of December and Easter.
A big shout out to Lonely Planet for sending thousands of visitors our way.
Lonely Planet, yes. I don't know if you're listening out there somewhere. Maybe if this goes out as a podcast. Lonely Planet, if we ever catch your roving reporters on the island again, they're shark bait. End of story. Thanks for nothing.
So, people are coming in, getting their passport stamped, a big flag waving out there at the airport. Do you think we're going to see that flag pulled down and replaced with a new one?
I doubt it. I doubt it very much.
You've got your voting papers?
I haven't got mine yet.
Yeah. I think most polls are picking that we're going to stick with the flag, which means it's a great waste of time. And the process was flawed. I think everyone agrees. Yeah. The way they went about it was just completely ridiculous. And at the end of the day, it's just going to be a waste of money.
I'm sorry, can I pull you up there? The use of the expression "at the end of the day" has now been banned.
Is it? Okay. Well, yes, actually, Alan.
Our Prime Minister uses it too often, and I think that's one of those ones you've just got to put a piece of duct tape over and say, no, we can't use that one anymore.
No, it was quite the reason I threw it in. I mean, at the end of the day.
At the end of the day, yes. Yeah, as you say, the process was hopelessly flawed and has just annoyed a lot of people.
I think they didn't even really have any. Now, there's a word for someone who's a flag expert.
There is a
long, great word. But these are people who have actually, studied the whole art of what makes a flag, what makes it effective, why it's such a powerful emblem for a nation. There wasn't any of those on the panel. I think Julie Christie from MediaWorks, responsible for reality television shows galore, was on the panel. And really, what she was doing there is a big question. We should have probably put Donald Trump on there as well. He would have helped the process no end.
I would say it's pretty much certain that we will not change the flag, I find it interesting that the first genuine real setback for this government should be something over which they themselves had complete control, because it's more usual to see a government start to falter when circumstances beyond their control contribute to that. Whereas with this issue, they could have left well alone. In fact, I'm sure had they realised how badly it was going to go, they would have left it alone.
Well, once a ponytail botherer, always a ponytail botherer.
So it's a vexillologist.
Vexillologist, that's the one, yes.
Yeah. So we were missing a vexillologist. It's interesting because, there are a few, I suppose, themes that flow through the commentary on the flag thing. We get a number of people who say, I've seen any number of people who say, I'm not going to vote for the new flag because I don't support John Key. But yet, on the other hand, I haven't seen a single person say, I'm going to vote for the new flag because that John Key is a great guy.
Yes. I haven't heard anyone say that.
No. And while I've heard many people say that $26 million could have been spent on alleviating child poverty, I haven't heard anyone say that $26 million could have been spent on increasing police armaments.
Yeah. I think there's more a feeling that people will vote for the current flag because they feel angry and insulted at the way the process was mishandled.
I certainly feel like I agree with what Karen Hayes got to say about it, that we've been manipulated. When you've got, Dan Carter and Richie McCaw going, hey, flag, flag, we just run with the World Cup, by the way, flag, flag.
Yeah.
And they've got the money to be running these advertising campaigns, whereas the people who don't want it don't have the money. They, having to be crowdsourced. So it's obviously a very uneven playing field, and that just wreaks the manipulation. And then when you've got John Key turning around at the last moment and going, let's not make it about me, actually, at the end of the day, it's crap.
Yeah, the pro flag change people are getting pretty desperate, and it's interesting to see the way the media is handling it as well, because they're picking up on some of the spin from the flag change crowd, but then there's quite a few columnists who are really echoing the wider public mood and saying, yeah, this is just rubbish.
And, so we've got two here for the. for the existing flag?
I don't like the existing flag, but I'm not voting for the new one. I'll vote to keep it the way it was.
I'd love to be able to disagree with Alan, but I absolutely agree myself. I really feel we could ditch the Union Jack. You know, it's part of our heritage, yes, and the flag has played an important part. There's a lot of war veterans, families who've had their parents and grandparents actually go to war, which, you know, of course I don't agree with anyhow, but I don't want the RSA chasing me down the road. But I think it is time perhaps we revisited that. But I think the common consensus is it's going to wait until we actually become a republic. And if that happens, yes.
I mean, right now, looking as we were at America, I'm tempted to say, well, remind me again what's so great about republics. They're not that great. The idea that somehow you stagger along in this foggy state of being in a monarchy and then suddenly you are enlightened by becoming a republic is utter nonsense. If anything, the republic is the old-fashioned idea. It has, after all, been around for 3,000 years or so, whereas the idea of a constitutional monarchy is a relatively newfangled idea. And it's noticeable that those countries that people are queuing to get into generally tend to be the ones that have monarchs. People behave like the Royal House of Windsor is the only monarchy left, whereas in fact there are many, many countries around the world which have monarchies and who do fine. And the list of really good functioning republics is an incredibly small one, consisting mainly of, well, there's France, there's Germany, and there's Ireland. Those would be your three best republics. Those countries have great big queues of people wanting to get into them. You'd sort of still grudgingly include America on the list. It still basically functions. But apart from that, anyone else got any suggestions?
Yeah, no, not really. I was actually thinking of, when you said enlightenment, I was thinking, well, or lack thereof, and many thought of Peter Dunne, his royal peacockness, and the fact that it's been revealed that Martin Crowe was self-administering liquid marijuana.
Oh, yes, poor chap.
Last day, poor chap. Sadly missed, great cricketer, and very sad indeed. But it does indeed highlight the ridiculousness of those laws, especially in the face of Helen Kelly, who's done amazing things for New Zealand,
yes,
in her role.
And meanwhile, unions. On the same subject, we see that this week the local police are patting themselves on the back for having destroyed the livelihoods of numerous people who were just growing a few plants in their back gardens. Those people will now have criminal records, possibly face losing jobs. They'll have to go to court, pay fines. And for what? What was the point of that? The police would have been much better organising a speed camera on only Tangy Strait, which is something we actually need. What we do not need is the Rozzers raiding people just for a few dope plants.
The thing Ridiculous. That interests me is the complete lack of foresight. We can see what's happening in America, Colorado, the other states, Washington. It's being legalized. It's being, you know, they've got an organized system for licensing it, for managing it, and it seems to be working bloody well. Colorado's made so much money out of taxing it, and that's money that's going back into the community. And I think, you know, generally we're seeing worldwide is that drug issues are now being seen as a health issue as opposed to a criminal issue.
Yeah.
But then, of course, you've got the whole thing of trying to keep these privately run prisons full of people, which is a bit of a bugger.
Well, certainly, yeah, it doesn't appear we're going to have any sensible move forward until we can sort of drown Peter Dunne in a bucket or something like that, which would be really handy.
I think it's would probably keep him afloat, Alan.
Yeah. So. People of Ohio Belmont, why do you keep electing this puffed-up, bow-tie-wearing fraud to public office? It's your fault.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So let's just round off with another look at another local issue, which is, you know, Maitiatia. So we've been through, we've had the process of Maitiatia and the marina resolved. Incidentally, I invited Graham Guthrie to come onto the show today to talk about because
how his summer's been
on
apart
it.
From that. Yes,
yes, but yeah, he declined, so that, which is fine. So, but you know, we're now into this process where the local board or some of the local board have said that, you know, they want to develop a plan and Direction Maitiatia, the group who organised a large part of that opposition to the marina, have been granted a significant amount of money to develop a report. So there seems to be, I suppose, in this, you know, the question of the development of the report itself, but also maybe the process of it that seemed to have raised a few eyebrows.
Oh, a few, yes, but we know whose eyebrows in particular. You know, certainly that most ex of ex community board members is questioning why a group called Direction Martyrtyr would know anything about Martyrtyr. So, yeah, same old, same old. As far as I think most people are concerned, the community would say, if Direction Martyrtyr are being given further authority over that area, then great. Who else would you rather trust?
Exactly.
I think it's a fine idea.
They've done their homework extensively, and they've talked to all the concerned groups, and they're aware of all those issues, so I think it's in safe hands.
What do you think about the process of the allocation of the funds?
It does seem to be something that gets opponents of the board upset. And yes, I would hope as we get into the election time, if any of the incumbents seek re-election, that they will be able to produce the figures and go, yep, we stand by all of this. And there is a reasonable, it's reasonable to assume that they probably will. After all, the incumbent board have a rock-solid mandate. So if people want to criticise the way that they do stuff, we'll let it wait until the election.
Yeah, and that's going to be interesting.
They were given a very, very good margin at the last election. And if they choose to spend money the way they want to, I think the local support for that is pretty good.
I think we're being a bit half-hearted, actually. I think we should declare Waiheke independent. I think we
should have
our own border. We should be have passports, charging people to come in. I also would love to see us being energy independent. I don't know how I can possibly realise these dreams, but I'd love to see generators up in the channel, wind, solar. So we don't have this dependence. I'd love to see the ferries being run on hydrogen, which we generate here, and all the profits going back into the community. This is a sort of vision that I've got for the island.
Yes, Bruce has a dream.
So
lovely, but I'm not sure how that would work.
So there was some homework, and you weren't here last month, obviously, Bruce, but you had some homework, Alan, which
yes,
was to bring a prediction for 2016.
Yes, bring a prediction. Well, I think the best thing that I can come up with is that there will be a resurgent sort of pro-business bid for control of the local board, which will fail dramatically.
Okay. Now, you didn't know about this, Bruce, so throwing you on the spot here. If you're looking forward to looking ahead 2016 on the island, have you got a prediction?
I think it's going to be even busier. Even at the moment when the season's meant to be tailing off, you still can't find a park at ridiculous times in the morning when you come up. It's trying to pull out. It's like driving in Ponsonby, for heaven's sake. So I think it's just going to get more and more of that. There's going to be more and more pressure on accommodation. I think someone's going to have to step up and provide some budget accommodation. Someone's going to have to kick it open, because otherwise we're going to get these increasing problems of people sleeping in cars, people sleeping in the bushes, people sleeping on little nudie beach and starting fires with bits of trees that they've pulled off. And I think we're just going to see more of that.
Or, alternatively, is it possible that this is the peak of it? That enough people are going to have visited the island, not been able to get served anywhere, not been able to catch buses, have stood around in the heat going, this is just awful. And that we're actually going to see the downslide now because we have pushed our luck too far.
Don't think so. The theory of the long tail, I think, is going to hold. There's so many people that are going to go and say, yeah, we had a fantastic time. We hear the odd gripe, Alan, of people, you know, can't get served, or there's a queue here and a queue there. But, you know, these are people who are coming from overseas. They've probably visited Europe, which is just so full of Europeans, you queue for a week to use a public toilet. So I don't think it's going to be too surprising to them. And they're going to go away and they're going to tell more people. And so we're going to see a roll-on effect for a number of years yet. I don't think we've seen the voice.
Well, then at what point will that backlash come against that? Because it is just getting a bit much now.
I've noticed that. I've noticed that a lot of the locals are starting to really grumble. And I remember when I first came to Waiheke and there was people grumbling then. They're going, well, this is too much. We're off to grow our marijuana on Great Barrier. This is just too crazy. And then it's kind of, we're almost back at that point again when a lot of the locals are going, oh, I can't stand it anymore. Might as well live in Auckland.
It's just that, you know, it used to be a lot of fun on the island in summer. It's long ago stopped being fun. Now all we do is we get on the treadmill every morning because we have this obsession that the more and more and more visitors we get, the better we're doing. But are we? Costs are going up, wages aren't rising. I don't think we're much better off. All we're doing is we are feeding the need of a few business owners who've borrowed too much money and are now panicking because they have to make their businesses work. And it's all very well for those business owners to go, oh, you know, we're all in this together. But are we? No, we're not. Wages are still poor and they do not keep up with the cost of living.
Let's pick that one up next month because we're about to head off into another half hour there.
Which we could so easily do.
An interesting point, you know, when we talk about that it is good for the island, you know, who is it good for? So we'll pick that up next month. We've been talking to the opinionated islanders Alan Knight and Bruce Davis Goff. So thank you very much to both of you for joining us. And the opinionated islanders will be back on the first Saturday of next month here on Island Life on Waiheke Radio.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
A couple of weeks ago, Waitangi Day, a lot of people arrived down at the Marae, as happens each year, and a great day down there. The weather had cleared and lots of people queuing up for the hangi and all the rest of it. And I was roped in by the Waiheke Island Council of Social Services to help out with a project that they're kind of, I suppose, in the development stages of, looking at community development. So my job was to talk to people who were there and ask them their thoughts about Waiheke. And so they were kind of, we followed kind of three themes really, which were what do you like about Waiheke Island, what would you change if you could, and do you have aspirations for the future? So I'll just give you a bit of a taster here.
I'm Sally, and the thing I like best is the great community of people.
If you could change one thing, what would you change?
I'd probably limit the number of visitors to the island because I don't think we can sustain the island with the big influx of visitors.
And do you have an aspiration for the future of the island?
That we continue to grow as the community that we are rather than becoming just a tourist destination.
Kia ora, I'm Pohiria Witi, and the most thing I love about Waiheke is that we can leave our cars and our homes open and our children are always safe.
And if you could change one thing, what would you change?
John Key being our Prime Minister.
And do you have an aspiration or vision for the future of the island?
To retain our traditions and our cultural and integrity, and to ensure that my children's children can enjoy the lifestyle that we still lead here today.
So there's a couple of samples of the feedback we got asking people about their vision for Waiheke Island, and to talk about the project that that's part of from Waiheke Island Council of Social Services is Miran Lawler. Good morning, Miran.
Good morning, Chris.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, why was I out with the microphone asking people those questions? Mm.
One of the things that the Waiheke Island Council of Social Services, or WICOS, has recognised over probably the last couple of years is that while we have such a vibrant community, we have a community that isn't well resourced in terms of the community investing in outcomes around projects and a vision for Waiheke. So what WICOS has started to do is to have some conversations with a range of funding bodies with a view to obtaining or securing a community development worker on the island. And one of the reasons for going out and getting this sort of feedback, and we're going to be doing that in a whole variety of ways, is that for a community development project to be truly about community development, it has to be informed by the community. So it's not about a bunch of people working in social services or the community sector saying, this is what the island needs. It's about the community outlining what it loves about itself, what it hopes for the future, and then resourcing the community to achieve that vision.
I suppose one of the challenges in any of these projects is how you ensure that you're truly reaching the diverse views of the community. You know, I mean, I've been editing up those clips from the Marae, and there's a certain to a certain degree, perhaps the responses aren't unexpected, and there's a uniformity across the responses, you know, because those are the people who will come together at the marae on Waitangi Day. How do you ensure that you're going to get a widespread?
I think it's fair to say that one of the things about the Waiheke community is that pretty much every Waihekean has an opinion, whether it's about what they like about the island or what they'd change about the island. And there are some obvious key forums in which those opinions are shared, but they do tend to be shared by those who feel confident in expressing their views. And there are a lot of people on the island who, for example, don't use Facebook, don't necessarily go to the library where we hope to have a vision tree installed, don't necessarily attend a range of community forums. And so we'll be working over the course of putting this application together, which will be occurring between now and September, in identifying all of the different sectors and sections of the population and the best way to liaise with them. So, for example, one of the areas where we're really aware that when there are community surveys on Waiheke, one of the areas that is often missed out is young people and particularly children.
Oh, I tried. Oh, they're so hard to get to talk.
Absolutely. There's an entire community development program that can be run in schools that's designed to elicit this sort of information. So we're going to be seeking to work with the schools in order that, you know, a five-year-old can have their say about what they like about Waiheke and what they want to see for the future of their home.
Excellent. So what are the next steps for the project?
The next steps are we're putting in an expression of interest, but we'll be continuing to identify sections of the population, and there'll be lots of information coming out in the local newspapers and the way that information circulates in the community about opportunities for people to have a say. We'll also hopefully be piggybacking on some of the information that comes out of the essentially Waiheke process that's occurring at the moment. But from our perspective, we're really interested to hear from every person on Waiheke and for it to not be politically driven. It really is, this is what I love about Waiheke and this is what I hope for my future.
Well, good luck with that.
Thanks, yeah. Chris.
Thanks very much, Miran. Okay, so we're rattling on through things here on Island Life this morning. Let's get this going. So this is local band Radio Ribaldi, and they're all here, so let's get them in. As I said, that's Radio Ribaldi, and I have the whole of Radio Ribaldi in the studio. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning. So you're here to promote a gig that you have coming up. Where and when?
That's right. Next Saturday at what time, guys?
Saturday the 12th at Artworks at 9 p.m.
So, I mean, the energy and the passion come through in the music. What can people expect, you know, what can people expect on the night?
I think lots of bodies without shirts, sweaty. That's the plan.
Yeah, and that's the band. And what about the audience?
That's the same same way. Just a big ocean of sweat.
So the band's been around for quite a long time. You went into a bit of hiatus for a while, and you're back, and it seemed to be back with a lot of passion, energy, and direction. What's the future hold? Oops, there
better,
you go.
Really, better and better, more and more, more fiesta,
more dancing, more shouting, more music.
One of the things that I've really liked is that, you know, you've been developing some of your own material, you've been recording some more of that in store.
Absolutely, yeah, we're definitely going to be kind of recording more and putting it out there. We're looking for festivals as well, maybe Womad next year. We'll be sending out some promotional material and see if we can get off the rock for a while.
Excellent. So this gig is likely to be a sellout, I would imagine.
Yes, possibly.
Yep. So where do people?
We're very modest.
Where do people get tickets?
At the door.
Rest?
At the door. We are very old school in that sense. Just come along and come 8:30 or whatever you like. And hopefully we'll be full. Possibly. So far, the Facebook event we created already has like 100 people saying they will attend. So we assume that it will be a couple of hundred people attending, which is to full capacity of artworks.
It sure is. It's bound to be, as you say, a hot and sweaty night. And beyond the 12th of March, plans beyond there?
The band is an ever-evolving beast. It's ever-changing. And let's watch and see, suck and see kind of thing. We always go through an autumn-winter hibernation period of reinventing the band. And Pete, who's our musical director in a way, playing trumpet and trombones and guiding us all into the good things to do. It's about to leave the band, so it will be a farewell gig for him, and
will
be very sad and hard to recover from. But hopefully we'll convince him to come back every now and then to play with us. We'll be another iteration, another version of Radio Rebeldia after in spring, possibly. But just on the night, we also have Chica Licorica, DJ, playing great, tunes that she does, closing the night for us. And also we have VJ and DJ doing an intro opening for us called Mano Paco Francisco, who has amazing visuals. And we'll set up the scene for us on the Saturday.
Excellent. So if people want to check out, if you haven't heard Radio Rebeldia before, there is a live set from your performance outside the library. Mm-hmm. There's a live set that you can hear on the Waiheke Radio website. So you can go and check out the whole live set there and get a taste for what you're in for. And Pete, you've got your trumpet. So you're gonna play us out.
Yes.
Let's go for it. So
come on, you can do it, Pete.
Yeah. So let's turn that microphone and we'll... There we go.
Go, Pete.
Fantastic. The Radio Rebeldia live at Artworks on the 12th of March, 9 p.m. Tickets, $10 at the door. Thanks very much for coming in, guys.
See you.
I'm Jennifer Fletcher, and one thing I like is the feeling of being away from the rat race and the sense of having a bit of individualism.
If you could change one thing, what would you change?
I think I'd like to change... the way that, basically having our own council would be great. So getting away from the Auckland Council, because we don't have that sense of control as to what happens on the island. It's taken over by somebody that has no idea about what we're experiencing.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. Every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onewarra.